It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Okay, I know I say this a lot, but holy cow, this was a week in this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 29th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, full disclosure. Sometimes on a Friday, when I'm teeing up our regular segment about the week that we do at the top of the show, like right here, sometimes, you know, sometimes when I review the economic week that was, I do it with, shall we say, great enthusiasm, really great enthusiasm. And don't get me wrong, I am enthusiastic. I love my job, but you got to make people want to listen, right? You got to sell it a little bit. Well, absolutely no need to amplify the economic enthusiasm this week. Believe you me, the Fed, gross domestic product, another inflation reading today. And those are just the headlines. So here we go. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, I'm going to go straight to my list of questions here that I have scribbled, and I will read you literally what the first one says. Something about Fed, GDP, and inflation. So I'm going to throw it to you with, give me the grand unifying theory of this week in this economy.
Boy, the grand unified theory. Look, everything feels wobbly right now, right? Everything in the economy feels wobbly. We're all uncertain about inflation. We've had all this chatter about a recession when the real recession hasn't even come yet. People just feel unsettled despite having strong wage growth, despite having remarkably high job growth, remarkably low unemployment. But everybody just feels unsettled because the whole thing feels a little wobbly. And what we've seen for the first 6 or 7 months of the year has kind of just been the precursor to what the real effects become. We've had stock market being a little wobbly. We've had interest rates climbing, but we haven't really seen the housing market fully come apart as a result of raising interest rates this quickly. We haven't really seen the issues in emerging markets. We haven't really seen consumers get strapped. All of that is the natural consequence of what we've started with, but we're not there yet.
That is not inspiring that we haven't yet seen the effects of it. Anna, let me ask you this. If you had to pick one of the biggies of this week, right, the Fed and the interest rates and Powell's press conference, GDP, which came in at -0.9% for the second quarter, the first reading, or this morning's reading on inflation, the PCE. I forgot what PCE stands for. Anyway, you guys help me out. Somebody help me out.
Personal consumption.
Thank you. Personal consumption expenditure. Look, I'm just live radio. That's just what happened. Anyway, PCE this morning at 6.8% year on year. Pick one. Which one's your favorite? Which one's the most significant?
Oh, wow. So I was going to try to weave it together, too, if I can.
Yeah, go ahead.
To give kind of my grand theory as well. And I hope you'll like this. My theory is that we're waiting to see if we're in a Wile E. Coyote moment when he's run off the
cliff. Is that when he's off the edge of the cliff just hanging?
Yet.
That's a good one. I like that.
Right. So if you look around, I think for a lot of people, the economy still feels pretty good. And you saw some of that in consumer spending today, which rebounded. Mm-hmm. The labor market is slowing, but it still feels pretty strong. strong. GDP fell, you know, mostly the drag in growth was really from company inventory. But, you know, the question is, have we already run off the cliff? But we're still not, we're just not feeling it yet. Jay Powell says that we haven't, and he's a smart guy. So I don't really know, but the Fed has been hiking really aggressively. And when the economy falls into a recession, that can happen pretty quickly. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean there couldn't be a recession right around the corner.
Sudeep, what do you make of Powell having said on Wednesday in his press conference, what do you make of him having said, you know, the path to a soft landing now depends on things outside our control? That is not a heartening thing to hear the Fed chair say.
It is not heartening, but he's actually being honest. He's being real about this in this moment. He has essentially admitted that the path to getting inflation down without a recession is narrowing, like the soft landing approach is narrowing. He sees all of these forces building up. If you're Jay Powell, the last thing you want to see in this moment is bond yields completely dropping this quickly and undoing the hard work of tightening, stock markets surging again. This is not what you want to see. You have to tighten policy. You need more restrictive policy to be able to actually force some pain onto the economy so it's not devastating for everyone. And the pain just seems to be disappearing. And it's just not, that's not what you want to see. And if you're in Jay Powell's shoes, it's going to get harder to actually bring inflation down to a reasonable level. Yeah, we can drop it from 9 to 6. But 6% inflation is not anywhere close to the Fed's 2% goal, or 3% if you want to go to that stage. And he realizes, okay, this just isn't working in the low pain way, and you're going to have to go to a higher pain threshold to make it happen.
Anna, how much does it matter that Congress now has apparently decided with the Inflation Reduction Act that Joe Manchin has now agreed to, that Congress has said, okay, we're going to get in somewhat on the fight against inflation?
Well, I definitely think the Inflation Reduction Act is a bit of kind of creative rebranding, right?
So, I mean,
this was what was recently was, you know, mostly the Build Back Better Act. You know, the argument is that investments in manufacturing and clean energy will help lower inflation over the long term by increasing supply and lowering costs for things like goods, things like energy. And I think that argument has a lot of merit, but those effects take time to materialize. And in the short term, you've still got very hot inflation, and you've got these massive influxes of fiscal spending coming into the economy to build new roads, incentivize spending on solar panels and clean cars and things like that. The Inflation Reduction Act, I definitely think, it's a bit of kind of creative rebranding, which is kind of par for the course in Washington.
Just because I know you follow this stuff, what do you make of the CHIPS Act and industrial policy now rearing its interesting head again, right, in Congress?
Yeah. So I was speaking with an economist recently who said it's the biggest industrial policy investment in Washington in 50 years. So it's definitely significant. Industrial policy has kind of been a dirty word in Washington for a long time. But there's this increasing consensus that the U.S. has ceded, a lot of the market to countries with a more interventionist industrial policy like China, and that the U.S. has to take this more active role. So this CHIPS bill is $280 billion towards the chip industry, but also basic R&D and research hubs. And, you know, when you combine that with the infrastructure bill and this new reconciliation bill that we were just talking about with the climate change initiatives, this is starting to add up to a massive investment in the U.S. economy.
A little bit of everything today on the wrap, including me forgetting part of my job, I guess. Anyway, Anna Swanson at the New York Times, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, July in the markets ends on an up note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. To put it bluntly, extremely bluntly, and he would almost certainly protest were he here, Jay Powell probably doesn't want you to get a raise right now. Not you, you, the individual person in this economy working hard at getting by, but you, the anonymous member of the American labor force. It's the whole wage price spiral thing we've been talking about. Prices going up as they are, then people asking for higher wages to afford those higher prices as they are. A survey from the staffing firm Robert Half shows more than 60% of workers plan on asking for a raise this year, with reason number one being the rising cost of living. Marketplace's Matt Levin tells us how those negotiations are playing out.
If you haven't got a raise since last June, you're making about 9% less than you did in 2021. That's just inflation math. With the labor market still tight, why not storm into your boss's office and demand to make at least as much as you were last year?
Inflation gives you a very solid metric. This is not a subjective explanation. It's purely objective, and it's very rational.
Maury Tahiripour teaches negotiation at UPenn's Wharton School. To be clear, she doesn't advocate storming into anyone's office. But she says smart executives know rising living costs don't just impact their employees' pocketbooks, but also their productivity.
You know, laying your head down at night and not knowing whether you're going to be able to afford your rent in a month. I think it actually affects your performance. You can't help it.
Of course, even the most enlightened boss may not have the budget for a major raise for all employees. Execs may be more willing to negotiate things aside from salary, says Professor Bobby Thomason at Pepperdine.
What they can offer is more vacation or more flexibility or some other sort of benefit.
Like more remote work options or maybe a one-time retention bonus. Hannah Riley Bowles at the Harvard Kennedy School says that while workers have almost unprecedented leverage right now, it's not clear how that will impact the gender pay gap, since research suggests men are typically more likely to push for a raise.
If you have a moment in history where there's likely to be a surge in requests for pay increases, we could come out of this pinch period with more men having negotiated raises than women.
Wiley says she's also not sure how long this leverage will last with the economy slowing down. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Any day now, college students are going to start heading back to campus, and while most of them probably do have their housing situations taken care of, the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice at Temple University says its annual surveys show that more than 40% of college and university students say they have experienced housing insecurity at school. And that's a data point, by the way, that has held true both before and during the pandemic. One of the key factors is that there just isn't enough student housing. And this year could be even worse than usual, thanks to pent-up demand to live on campus after a couple of years of on-again, off-again in-person schooling and rising rents off campus. So, as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, schools are getting creative to plug the gap.
At one point, the housing waitlist at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City had 3,000 names on it. So the school leased a building from another college, converted an on-campus hotel to student housing, and it turned to alumni in the area to ask whether they'd be interested in renting to current students. Bethany Hardwig is leading that program.
The student and the host can fill out a profile form that has kind of been compared to an online dating form. This is who I am. This is what I do. This is what field I work in.
At Long Beach City College in Los Angeles County, there aren't any dorms. Traditionally, students have lived at home or on their own. But last fall, the school discovered that 70 students were living in their vehicles. The school's planning to build some housing, but in the interim, it's allowing students to park their cars in a secured structure and giving them access to showers and Wi-Fi. Uduak Joe Intuk is president of the college's board.
These students need help today, and this is, you know, a stopgap measure that we can intervene and try to address a substantial barrier to their academic success.
A lack of affordable housing can be a barrier to even attending college. Mark Huelsman is with the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice at Temple University.
We run the risk of calcifying class inequality in higher education if there are some places that have figured it out and others don't.
Huelsman points out that most students aren't eligible for federal housing aid. He says changing that would go a long way towards solving the problem. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In itself, the sand isn't that special. It's just sand.
Sadly, not a trip to the beach coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 315 on this Friday, 0.9%, 32,845. The NASDAQ up 228 points, about 1.8%, 12,390. The S&P 500 ticked up 57 points, 1.4%, 41.30. Forget the week, let's do the month, shall we? The Dow added 6.7% in July. The NASDAQ up more than 12%. S&P 500 up more than 9%. Perhaps no surprise here, big oil companies are reporting big second quarter profits, confirming that these are indeed boom times in the energy sector. ExxonMobil found 4.6%. Chevron gushed up nearly 9%. With those company earnings in mind, by the way, we turn, as we often do, to what consumers are going to pay to tank up. AAA logs today's average gas price at $4.25 a gallon. A month ago, that average was higher, more like $4.86. A year ago, though, we all know this, $3.16 a gallon. The women's European soccer title is on the line Sunday with a final between England and Germany. Odds makers are already scoring no matter who wins. The sports gambling company Entain says it has registered a record 1.5 million online bets in the tournament. Entain says 14% of those bets have been made by women. I say England by two goals. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two observations about the renter's life in this economy right now. First of all, according to Apartment List, rents are up 12% from a year ago. So there's that. Also, we are just a little bit short of 1 year since the Supreme Court struck down the CDC's eviction moratorium. Now, some states and some cities do have eviction protections of their own in place, but rising rents and more limited eviction protections does seem kind of perilous. So we got Carl Gershenson on the phone. He is the project director at the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, and I asked him about the state of evictions today.
Eviction activity in the United States looks like it's returning approximately to where it was before the pandemic. If you look at our data going from 2000 up to around 2018, it's just really steady. Like the same communities see just about the same number of evictions year after year. And it was the massive federal interventions that we saw in the wake of the coronavirus that was really the only time in history that we've seen significant reduction in eviction activity. So now, 2 years later, with the protections expired, with most of that rental aid running out, it looks like we are right back where we started.
just super quick, so that everybody picks up on the word you use, communities. We are talking here mostly about communities of color and communities on the lower end of the income spectrum.
That's correct.
Yeah.
There is sort of a fractal pattern with the geography of evictions. If you want to know which region of the country has the highest eviction rates, you know, look for regions of the country with large Black populations. Hmm. If you want to know which neighborhoods in those states experience high levels of eviction, again, you look for the most segregated neighborhoods.
It's my understanding that there is no comprehensive tracking of evictions at the federal level. And in fact, the Eviction Lab that you run is the biggest and best data set. And it, of course, brings to mind, maybe it was Peter Drucker, I don't know, but the whole you can't manage what you don't measure thing. How can we handle an eviction crisis without knowing the numbers?
That's exactly right. And we think that this is something which really it will take the federal government to invest in if we want up-to-date information about eviction filing rates everywhere in the country. You know, if we can get the data, anyone can,
right.
including credit companies and tenant screening companies. And so there is this real tension between wanting to protect the privacy of renters and allowing researchers to study it. So, you know, you can only solve that tension if it's the federal government who is collecting this and selectively disclosing these data.
So what would it take to put the Eviction Lab out of work? In other words, to make you lose your job, right? I mean, because ideally evictions would fall to zero and you wouldn't have a place to go in the morning. What would that take?
I think that it would take this country seriously investing in housing and seriously tackling poverty. 80% of renters who earn under $25,000 are rent burdened. You know, that means that they spend more than 30% of their already small income on rent. And we've seen what rents have done in the last 2 years. There's no indication that they're going to go down. So the squeeze on these low-income renters is just getting worse and worse. And, you know, middle-income renters are hurting too. Not as badly as low-income renters, but as rent levels go up, you know, everyone's feeling this more and more. You really need to tackle this from both sides. I mean, people need money, but we also need to make it easier and more affordable to build housing of high quality where people want to live.
And even if Congress decided to do that tomorrow, it's a decades-long challenge, right?
Exactly. And there's all sorts of things that we can do in the short to medium term that can stabilize tenancies. And that's where you get into all sorts of renter protection bills, like a right to counsel. You know, most tenants are not represented if they go to housing court. Things like that can help people stay in their homes. But the long-term goal has to just be structurally changing this untenable housing system that we have.
Carl Gershenson is the project director at the Eviction Lab. That's at Princeton University. Mr. Gershenson, thanks for your time, sir, and your expertise. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And that surprise legislative compromise that's pending before the Senate right now. This is the bill that West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin and Majority Leader Chuck Schumer rolled out earlier this week. Ana was talking about it a little bit. There's $369 billion in climate and energy spending and incentives. And inside that pot of money is a $10 billion manufacturing investment tax credit for using green energy, solar and wind, you know the list, right? One not small wrench in the gears of green energy, though, is something called intermittence. The sun doesn't always shine. The wind doesn't always blow. So power generators need to gather the renewable energy while they can and store it efficiently. That is, without too much loss and without too much cost, so they can use it when it's needed. And that is a challenge. There's a startup in Finland, though, that thinks it has a low-cost, low-tech solution. From the European Desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This online ad for the Vatanjankoski power plant in Finland projects a high-tech image, but the company is now harnessing the properties of a very low-tech material.
It's a large mass of sand. In itself, the sand isn't that special. It's just sand.
That's Matti Ulvenen of Polonite Energy, the startup that's developed the world's first commercially operated sand battery.
We are using sand that is heated up to a high temperature. The energy can be then stored for a long period of time.
100 tons of ordinary sand have been packed into a silo at the power plant. It's 23 feet high and 13 feet in diameter. The beauty of sand is that it retains the heat without loss for months on end. And, says the power plant boss, Pekka Pasi, it doesn't evaporate when you heat it up.
You can heat sand to a higher temperature than water. So we can heat the sand up to 500 degrees centigrade. So you have much more storage capacity in the same volume, in the same space.
His relatively small silo should provide enough heat for up to 100 houses, distributed via a district heating system, a local network of insulated pipes. Pasi loves the new technology.
It's quite cheap, because it doesn't have to be any special sand, so it's very inexpensive.
And he reckons it'll be cheap to run the system that heats the sand and then extracts the heat.
I expect that it will be really low maintenance, low-cost maintenance.
Polonite Energy, which developed and patented the battery's heating system, won't reveal the capital cost, but insists that overall it'll be up to 10 times cheaper than existing high-temperature storage methods. And because of those very high temperatures, says the company's Markku Ulonen, the technology won't only benefit residential customers.
Our system excels in high-temperature applications, so we can provide really cost-efficient high temperatures to industrial processes.
Steam for the food industry for cleaning and sanitizing equipment. And piping hot air for cement and steel production. Storing heat when renewable energy is plentiful, for use when it is not, makes perfect sense for Finland with its long, dark and bitterly cold winters. Especially now, says Ulonen, that Russia has cut off all gas supplies to the country after it applied to join NATO.
Well, the current geopolitical situation has definitely boosted the interest towards our system.
And he says the world's urgent need to make variable renewable energy more dependable has massively widened the market for the sand battery.
I would expect that the next one we build will be in Finland, but we hope to be global quite soon, so we are actually negotiating in like tens of different countries of potential applications.
One apparent flaw in the new technology, there's a global shortage of sand for construction. But the Finns maintain their battery will work with the lowest grade rough stuff available. And there's billions of tons of that around. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I didn't have a chance to get to it in the numbers. Had to get that England bet on the line, just so y'all knew it. But anyway, I want to take a second to talk bonds here. The 10-year Treasury, as you know, is our favorite. The yield today, 2.65%, which might be perplexing to the casual observer who knows the Fed is raising rates and so shouldn't the interest rate on the 10-year be going up? Well, yes, but the bond market is kind of calling the Fed's bluff and is saying, and Sudeep alluded to this, the bond market is saying it wants looser financial conditions. It wants to make money easier, which is, as Sudeep pointed out, definitely not what Jay Powell wants. All right, off we go. Here, though, your moment of economic context. The quickie again with the rates. Mortgages this time. Mortgage News Daily says the average for a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage today, 5.13%. It was 5.5%, maybe a little bit more, just like 2 weeks ago. Financial conditions easing. What that is. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarbrough is vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.